to hear. The Texas Supreme Court is considering the case after a lower court backed Exxon's attempts to use Rule 202 against the California officials. The ruling was later overturned on appeal. The appeal court sympathized with ExxonMobil by acknowledging an impulse to safeguard an industry that is vital to Texas's economic well-being, and saying that lawfare is an ugly tool by which to seek the environmental policy changes pursued by California municipalities. But the appeal court said the defendants did not have sufficient direct connection to Texas for the case to be heard in the state. ExxonMobil has tried to head off climate litigation before, with lawsuits claiming that the attorney generals of Massachusetts and New York were violating the company's rights by investigating it. Those moves were blocked by the Massachusetts Supreme Court and by a federal court. If the Texas Supreme Court allows its Rule 202 bid to proceed, ExxonMobil might expect a more sympathetic hearing for its claims in a state court system that has shown deference to big oil. ExxonMobil is facing a barrage of other lawsuits across the United States. A number accuse the company and other fossil fuel firms of breaching consumer protection laws by propagating misinformation about climate science. Naomi Oreskes said ExxonMobil went further than most other oil companies in seeking to hide the evidence of its own scientists collected about global heating and in running a disinformation campaign. Naomi Oreskes said, "They're pushing their freedom of speech as an issue because more than any other company, it's been proven by people like me and others that they have a track record of promoting half-truths, misrepresentations, and in some cases, outright lies in the public sphere." Oreskes added, "This is so well documented that unless they can come up with some strategy to defend it, they're in potentially pretty serious trouble."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Monday, the Yemeni army conducted retaliatory strikes on several targets in the United Arab Emirates. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the country launched 5 ballistic missiles and a large number of drones at Dubai and Abu Dhabi airports, an oil refinery in Musafa, and several other sensitive and important sites in the UAE. Local officials said 3 people were killed and 6 others injured after 3 fuel tanker trucks exploded in the storage facility of an Emirati oil firm in the Musafa area. Fires erupted in the Abu Dhabi International Airport, disrupting flights. This came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'arib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army said Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. The army warned the coalition of more painful attacks if it continues its aggression against Yemen.
Just because it is possible to bully or invade a country with little resistance, such as the cases with Yemen and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, doesn't mean that it should be done, and that countries have more of a responsibility to each other and the international community than they do to their own immediate self-gain. I had the privilege of attending many protests, in favor of Yemen and protests to stop the bombing and the harassment of Yemen when I was in New York City. And you can see this is a genuine movement. This is a so many people from all different walks of life are recognizing the horrors that are being committed against Yemen by Saudi Arabia, by the backed UAE, and it has to come to an end.
The Yemeni military has warned that the UAE won't withstand its future strikes. Earlier this week, Yemen said Saudi Arabia had once again seized a ship carrying much-needed fuel while en route to the country's Hodeidah port. Yemeni officials said the vessel had secured UN clearances to enter Yemen, but it was diverted to the Saudi coast of Jazan. Saudi Arabia has seized several Yemeni-bound fuel ships in recent months, despite an ongoing fuel crisis there. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel that had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The United Nations, however, called on Yemen to return the ship. It also condemned the country's recent retaliatory strikes on the UAE and called for all sides to exercise maximum restraint. It made no mention of the Saudi-led coalition's deadly strikes in Yemen.
And the United Nations has no right to demand that this UAE flagship be returned so it can go back into combat and slaughter goodness knows how many more innocent Yemeni civilians. And so I think that, Yemen should stand strong, the international community, the anti-imperialist international community should stand strong with Yemen and say absolutely not. Unless the UN is going to play fair and be neutral, and in this case be supportive of Yemen and the right to defense, then the UN has no business saying what should and should not be done in this conflict with the UAE.
Saudi Arabia and its allies have maintained a tight blockade on Yemen, where the population is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Riyadh imposed a blockade in 2015, the same year that it launched an air campaign on Yemen. Daily airstrikes have hit the country, leaving tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. The attacks have increased in recent weeks. Almost 7 years after the war started, and despite all the hardships the Arab country is enduring, the Yemeni retaliatory attacks are driving home the message that the Yemenis are not backing down until the aggression against their nation is ended.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is in hot water, facing a growing leadership challenge. Johnson had already run the gauntlet of public anger for his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Now, Johnson is under growing pressure from members of Parliament, some of whom Tory lawmakers, after revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. The scandal even worsened after it was disclosed that a party was also held in Downing Street the night before the funeral of Prince Philip last April, when mixing indoors was banned. The stories about rule-breaking get-togethers had caused deep anger, and to thousands who had lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, intense anguish and pain. The mix was potentially politically lethal for the entire Conservative Party. Johnson himself has shifted from the party's biggest asset, with a Brexit-fueled appeal separate to the Conservative brand, to its biggest liability. Not only had Johnson lost his respect, but also sticking with him risks further contaminating the party brand if the scandals continue. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologized for attending what he called only a work meeting at a time when social mixing was banned. Meanwhile, the opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity, saying Johnson broke the law, lied, and must resign. The opposition Labour Party, which has surged in the polls since the Partygate revelations began emerging last month, says Johnson is unfit for office. Sir Keir Starmer said the Prime Minister's actions and his inability to take any responsibility for them means he can no longer do his basic duties. A new poll released on Sunday showed that the Labour Party has opened up its biggest lead against the Tories since 2013 amid criticism levelled at Boris Johnson and his party over social gatherings during COVID-19 lockdowns. The poll conducted by Opinium says Johnson's personal approvals fall below the worst figures ever recorded by Theresa May. Just 22% of people approve of the job Johnson is doing as Prime Minister. Also, his party sinks to its worst vote shares since the general election, 10 points behind Labour. Also, around two-thirds of people surveyed believe Johnson and his colleagues have broken the rules and lied about it, and say Johnson should resign. That's why Boris Johnson secured a landslide election victory in 2019. But according to the poll, nearly half of Conservative voters at the 2019 election now say he should have stepped down. The Sunday Times reported that Johnson will look to get on the front foot and save his position by making a series of populist announcements in the coming weeks, including reducing the national health system backlog, tackling the small boat crossings in the Channel, freezing the BBC license fee for 2 years, and introducing a booze ban in Downing Street. But is that enough? The latest poll shows voters across the political spectrum are angry with the revelations, and most of those who supported the Conservatives in the 2019 election are turning against them. Add to it a looming cost of living crisis, inadequate public services, a pandemic to recover from, and ongoing difficulties caused by Brexit. It's now just a question of how long will Boris Johnson survive as the Prime Minister. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province on Friday.
The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture. And I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world, in the Middle East and globally.
since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an east-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now, the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products, in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these. And they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions, or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran's.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that Western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions. Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to his security demands.
We're waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we're not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov, his country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they could do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if de-escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were giving one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the U.S. and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the Republican Party in the United States, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Lisa Lehrer and Astrid Herndon. The piece is titled Menace Enters the Republican Mainstream. Threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the Republican Party, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics. At a conservative rally in western Idaho last month, a young man stepped up to a microphone to ask when he could start killing Democrats. "When do we get to use the guns?" he said, as the audience applauded. "How many elections are they going to steal before we kill these people?" The local state representative, a Republican, later called it a fair question. In Ohio, the leading candidate in the Republican primary for Senate blasted out a video urging Republicans to resist the tyranny of a federal government that pushed them to wear face masks and take FDA-authorized vaccines. When the Gestapo show up at your front door, the candidate, Josh Mandel, a grandson of a Holocaust survivor, said in the video in September, "You know what to do." And in Congress, violent threats against lawmakers are on track to double this year. Republicans who break party ranks and defy former President Donald J. Trump have come to expect insults, invective, and even death threats, often stoked by their own colleagues and conservative activists who have denounced them as traitors. From congressional offices to community meeting rooms, threats of violence are becoming commonplace among a significant segment of the Republican Party. 10 months after rioters attacked the United States Capitol on 6th of January, and after 4 years of a president who often spoke in violent terms about his adversaries, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force, as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodge them from power. In Washington, where decorum and civility are still given lip service, violent or threatening language still remains uncommon, if not unheard of, among lawmakers who spend a great deal of time in the same building. But among the most fervent conservatives who play an outsized role in primary contests and provide the Republican Party with its activist energy, the belief that the country is at a crossroads that could require armed confrontation is no longer limited to the fringe. Political violence has been part of the American story since the founding of the country, often entwined with racial politics and erupting in periods of great change. More than 70 brawls, duels, and other violent incidents embroiled members of Congress from 1830 to 1860 alone. And elements of the left have contributed to the confrontational tenor of the country's current politics, though Democratic leaders routinely condemn violence and violent imagery. But historians and those who study democracy say what has changed has been the embrace of violent speech by a sizable proportion of one party, including some of its loudest voices inside government and most influential voices outside of government. In effect, they warn the Republican Party is mainstreaming menace as a political tool. Omar Russell, a political scientist at Pomona College who studies protests and race, drew a contrast between the current climate and earlier periods of turbulence and strife, like the 1960s or the run-up to the Civil War. What's different about almost all those other events is that now there's a partisan divide around the legitimacy of our political system, he said. The elite endorsement of political violence from factions of the Republican Party is distinct for me from what we saw in the 1960s. Then you didn't have, from a president on down, politicians calling citizens to engage in violent resistance. From his earliest campaigning to the final moments of his presidency, Donald Trump's political image has incorporated the possibility of violence. Trump encouraged attendees at his rallies to knock the hell out of protesters, praised the lawmaker who body slammed a reporter, and in a recent interview defended rioters who clamored to hang Mike Pence. Yet even with the former president largely out of the public eye, and after a deadly attack on the Capitol where rioters tried to overturn the presidential election, the Republican acceptance of violence has only spread. Opinion polls indicate that 30% of Republicans and 40% of people who most trust far-right news sources believe that true patriots may have to resort to violence to save the country, a statement that gets far less support among Democrats and among independents. Such views, routinely expressed in warlike or revolutionary terms, are often intertwined with white racial resentments and evangelical Christian religious fervor, two potent sources of fuel for the GOP during the Trump era, as the most animated Republican voters increasingly see themselves as participants in a struggle, if not a kind of holy war, to preserve their idea of American culture and their place in society. Notably, few Republican leaders have spoken out against violent language or violent behavior since 6th of January this year, suggesting with their silent acquiescence that doing so would put them at odds with a significant share of their party's voters. When the Idaho man asked about killing political opponents at an event hosted by the conservative activist Charlie Kirk, Mr. Kirk said he must denounce the question, but went on to discuss at what point political violence could be justified. In that vacuum, the coarsening of Republican messaging has continued. Representative Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona, this week tweeted an anime video altered to show him killing Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and swinging two swords at Joe Biden. Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at the left-leaning group New America who has studied political violence, said there was a connection between such actions and the growing view among Americans that politics is a struggle between enemies. When you start dehumanizing political opponents, or really anybody, it becomes a lot easier to inflict violence on them, Dr. Drutman said. I have a hard time seeing how we have a peaceful 2024 election after everything that's happened now, he said. I don't see the rhetoric turning down. I don't see the conflict going away. I really do think it's hard to see how it gets better before it gets worse. Democrats are seeking Paul Gosar's censure, arguing that depictions of violence can foment actual violence and jeopardize the safety of elected officials. The ranking GOP lawmakers, Senator Mitch McConnell and Representative Kevin McCarthy, did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Kevin McCarthy, who initially condemned the 6th of January attack on the Capitol and said violence is never a legitimate form of protest, more recently has joked about hitting Nancy Pelosi in the head with a gavel if he were to replace her as Speaker of the House. Like nearly all of the members of his caucus, Kevin McCarthy has said nothing about Paul Gosar's video. For his part, Representative Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona, has suggested that critics were overly thin-skinned, insisting that the video was an allegory of a debate over immigration policy. He was slaying the policy monster of open borders, not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Joe Biden, his office said. It is a symbolic cartoon. It is not real life. Carlos Curbelo, a Republican former congressman from Florida who is a critic of Donald Trump, said Republicans needed to take a stronger approach against violent language and intimidation tactics. I do think the problem is more acute among Republicans because there are a handful of Republican officials who have no limits, he said. Your country and your integrity should be more important to you than your re-election. The increasing violence of Republican speech has been accompanied by a willingness of GOP leaders to follow Donald Trump's lead and shrug off allegations of domestic violence that once would have been considered disqualifying for political candidates in either political party. Herschel Walker, the former professional football player running for Senate in Georgia, is accused of repeatedly threatening his former wife's life. But won Donald Trump's endorsement and appears to be consolidating party support behind his candidacy. Donald Trump also backed the Ohio congressional campaign of Max Miller, who faces allegations of violence from his former girlfriend, the former White House press secretary Stephanie Grisham. Max Miller has sued Stephanie Grisham for defamation. And Sean Parnell, a Senate candidate in Pennsylvania who was endorsed by Donald Trump, appeared in court this week in a custody fight in which his estranged wife accuses him of choking her and physically harming their children. Sean Parnell denies the charges.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
It does actually, in their opinion, violate civil liberties, existing civil liberties of society. And of course, with the backdrop of COVID and the draconian measures, and on the back of 20 years of increased police powers after the anti-terrorism laws, etc., that have come in to counter terrorism, there's a sort of nervousness.
And here is why it matters. Women being manhandled and handcuffed by police for attending a peaceful vigil held last year in the wake of 33-year-old Sarah Everard's murder at the hands of a police officer.
While the Conservative government claims the bill is aimed at proactively preventing chaos and disruption caused, for example, by people who glue their faces to motorways, its critics say the bill is not about law and order, but about taking away their right to protest.
The proposed legislation was quickly pushed through the House of Commons last year. This week it was put up for debate at the upper chamber of the UK Parliament amid cries of kill the bill from drum-beating protesters, forming an emotive backdrop to it outside the legislative body. What ensued was several amendments made to the proposed legislation to the chagrin of the government.
There is a general trend for government to grab more and more power and to reduce civil liberties. This is what's worrying. I think that the Lords ultimately, as you say, won't be able to stop it entirely. They can slow the process down, water it down slightly, but if governments are inexorably marching towards a greater totalitarian orientated set of legislature, then I'm afraid that at the moment, with the climate the way it is, politically, economically, etc., I don't think it'll be terribly difficult for them to push it through.
Campaigners say the parliamentary defeat came because people took to the streets and raised the alarm about the government's growing authoritarianism. They say it is now time to build the movement and kill the contentious bill once and for all. Saeed Pereza, London.
Islamic and National Forces in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held under administrative detention in Israeli jails. The protest comes as hundreds of inmates have already boycotted Israel's military court, demanding an end to its illegal administrative detention.
About 500 administrative detainees began the new year by refusing to show up for their court sessions.
Israeli regime has renewed administrative detention against hundreds of Palestinian inmates. Palestinians and human rights groups should do their best to put an end to the cruel policy. We stand by our brothers in Israeli jails who have boycotted Israel's military court. We also call on international human rights organizations to take a serious action.
The boycott of Israel's military court by Palestinian inmates comes as the health of the Palestinian hunger striker Nasser Abu Hamed is deteriorating. He has been in a coma for 11 days while in custody. Palestinian factions say the intentional medical negligence practiced by Israeli regime aims at killing the Palestinian prisoners.
Our message is clear. We will always support our detainees who stand against the brutal policies of the Israeli regime. Our brother Nasser Abu Hamed is in coma for 11 days due to medical negligence as Israel refuses to release him to provide him with proper medication. This amounts to a criminal act against our prisoners.
Public protests are mounting day by day against Israel's decision not to release Nasser Abu Hamed. Palestinians say they will hold Israel accountable if the inmate dies.
About 500 Palestinian detainees are refusing to show up for their court sessions, saying that this move is aimed at putting an end to the illegal Israeli administrative detention policy. They are also demanding the release of the hunger-striking prisoner Nasser Abu Hamed, who's on the verge of death. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Strikes, protests, and parliamentary disunity have shown that opposition to President Emmanuel Macron's pandemic policies have reached unprecedented levels. Macron dominates his party, and his party dominates Parliament. But France's controversial new vaccine smart pass was only just approved after more than 2 weeks of parliamentary chaos. It's one of the strictest vaccine passes in the world because it requires full vaccination. The vaccine hesitant can no longer provide proof of a negative COVID test to avoid almost total public isolation. There have been weeks of protests in favor of the rights of the non-vaccinated, and unions are planning enormous walkouts against a pandemic response which is accused of being imposed from above and without enough grassroots input.
In the end, it was Macron who decided alone, and that's why it's a big confuse for everyone. So, and that's why it makes a lot of confusion in the population, because just one guy who decides everything and a scientific committee who is more a justification for the decision that has been taken.
Vaccines in France are popular. 80% of the formerly vaccine-skeptical nation is now fully vaccinated. That has many saying that seemingly scapegoating the unvaccinated is a way for Macron to solidify a precarious re-election bid.
Despite his immensely controversial tenure, Macron retains a hardcore base of support of around 20%. It's been long assumed that it will be enough to get him into the second round, where he will defeat a challenger from the far right, like in 2017.
The decision is are very influenced by the fact that the election are coming in April. So it's really difficult to go to the mandatory vaccination for Emmanuel Macron. Maybe he want to wait for his re-election to go from the vaccinal pass to the mandatory vaccination.
The vaccine pass will likely be contested in France's top court, but it is expected to go into effect this week. The Omicron variant is far less deadly than previous versions, giving hope that the pandemic is ending. But it appears that the nation's pandemic policies will be a major part of the presidential election this April. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Genocide, the deliberate destruction of an ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. There have been many, with death tolls in the millions, and the threat of another is always around the corner. Organizations like the IHRC are fighting to prevent that by raising awareness. The theme of this year's event, How Do States Sanitize Genocide?
Genocide is sanitized. It's not only the genocidal state which actively attempts to sanitize its crimes. Other states are also actively involved. Those which supply the weapons and other instruments of annihilation. Those which refuse to acknowledge or call out the genocide for fear of the obligations to prevent and punish the crimes taking place that they would be placed under. Those which fear offending trading partners.
There are more than 1,500 monuments across London commemorating everyone from controversial figures like Churchill to even fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes. But you would be hard-pressed to find a monument that commemorated the 1 million people killed in the Great Irish Famine, a genocide orchestrated by the British. The British government conveniently omits England's role in bringing about genocides like the so-called potato famine from schoolbooks, like many other regimes that weave history in a way that justifies crimes against humanity.
Here's a real chance for the UK government and the Department for Education to truly celebrate, or rather I should say commemorate, the diverse groups of people that it can encourage our systems and our schools to remember because of who their predecessor governments have exterminated in previous centuries, whether we're talking about the indigenous people of Australia, Malays, Chinese, Indian subcontinent, Iranians, Iraqis.
Genocide Memorial Day is held on the anniversary of Israel's Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to 2009, which killed hundreds of Palestinians. Again in 2021, thousands of Palestinians were killed at the hands of the Israeli regime, which legitimizes its actions by evoking another genocide, the Holocaust. The vicious cycle continues, and therefore, so must the fight against dehumanization and ethnic cleansing. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sadi said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab al-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
For
For Afghan students, the year 2021 was full of obstacles. The educational system was disrupted and many schools across remained closed, while a ban on girls returning to secondary schools is still in place. Now the Filimoy School has opened for students in Afghanistan to facilitate learning. This year on platform provides Afghan students with free educational courses. Samira and Fatima are students of secondary school. After being banned from attending their classes, they decided to join online courses.
Hello everyone, how are you?
Now they are students of Filimoy School and they are happy with everything it has provided.
It has been almost 152 days that we have been away from school. We felt very desperate. In order to stay involved with education, my friends and I gather here and benefit from Filimo School's online courses. The lessons and videos provided by Filimo are very interesting and creative.
Teachers and educational consultants believe that online courses are a good means of learning, especially at a time of crisis and pandemic. Mahdi Ishaqi, who is an education consultant, has found Filimo Online School very professional and useful for Afghan students.
I found the Filimo School extraordinarily useful, especially for Afghan students who are affected by a political crisis and the coronavirus pandemic. This is very valuable academically too. I'm sure our students highly welcome Filimo School because they are in need of such opportunities.
Filimo School says it has provided the service to Afghan students because of their difficult educational conditions. So now every Afghan boy and girl from preschool to the 9th grade can access the same lessons as Iranians do. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Naqab Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land, these are our villages, we've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume. But Israel is pushing ahead, taking no heed of those demands. Some experts believe Israel has been planning from the start to expand and perpetuate its occupation, and the two-state solution was never an option for the Tel Aviv to begin with.
There was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution. It's a delusion, and it's an illusion that was instituted by the Ben Gurion, the 1920s.
All these developments take place as the international community plays the role of a silent witness of the Israeli colonial policies. And all these Palestinian pleas for help and justice are falling on deaf ears. That has many wondering what can be done to make the world quit its role as a silent observer of the injustice that's been committed against Palestinians.
On Friday, EU foreign affairs and defense ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe cost in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace, all of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.